Did you know that the percentage of medical visits handled by healthcare providers other than physicians nearly doubled between 2013 and 2019? Many of those patients saw nurse practitioners.
I myself am a family nurse practitioner, so that means I could see patients from very young to the very old, and it varies based on the program that the nurse practitioner goes to. And today we have 385,000 nurse practitioners practicing across the U.S.
Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Ferrara. He holds a Doctor of Nursing Practice degree and is currently serving as the president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Dr. Ferrara has been a practicing nurse practitioner for over two decades, as well as faculty at Columbia University School of Nursing, served as the director of the Nurse Practitioner Association of New York State, where he led the work to remove many statutory barriers to practice. And now he's helping lead his profession.
What doesn't make sense to many people who are advocates for full practice authority is that there's no fundamental difference between a nurse practitioner in New York and one in Texas, for example. Yet what we can do as nurse practitioners is going to differ from that state law.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Stephen, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and of course, NPs have been part of the healthcare landscape for close to 60 years or so, but not all of our listeners may be up to speed on the education and training pathways to becoming a nurse practitioner. Just to be sure we're all on the same page, I wonder if you could just take a few minutes and explain the kind of education and training one goes through to become a licensed and board certified as a nurse practitioner.
Sure. Nurse practitioners are registered nurses first. So they have undergraduate degrees as a baccalaureate prepared nurse and are licensed in their states as a registered nurse. Those nurses that want to become nurse practitioners apply to graduate school, and they go back to school and enroll in a nurse practitioner program. The programs are anywhere from 2 to 3 years, and it varies whether it's a master's or doctoral levels. Both of these degrees are currently offered. And while the student, now RN student, the nurse practitioner student, is going for education, they're getting clinical rotations that they're doing in their primary specialties, mm-hmm. and they're getting additional education. Upon completion, these now graduates are taking board certification exams, national board certification exams, and can prescribe, diagnose, and treat patient conditions for which the specialty that they are licensed in. So our specialties are a little bit different than medicine. When we talk about specialties, we talk about family specialty, adults, women's health, psychiatric mental health. These are the specialties that some of the specialties that nurse practitioners go to school for. I myself am a family nurse practitioner, so that means I could see patients from very young to the very old, and it varies based on the program that the nurse practitioner goes to. And today we have 385,000 nurse practitioners practicing across the U.S.
I've been a family nurse practitioner for decades myself and have seen firsthand the tremendous impact NPs have had on practice and healthcare in the U.S., and also the gradual expansion of what we think of as scope of practice based on the research and the evidence of safety and quality of care. Now, when you were the executive director of the New York Nurse Practitioner Association, you succeeded in gaining full practice authority for NPs in New York State. Now, 27 states and the District of Columbia grant full practice authority. But the question is, why not all 50 states? What's the evidence for full practice authority? And what do you see as the obstacles to getting the rest of the states on board?
Yeah, that is a great question. There is robust evidence in the nearly 60 years that nurse practitioners have existed in this country that supports that nurse practitioners provide high quality, cost effective care. The challenge is that when it comes to the Nurse Practice Act, and I won't get too far into the weeds, but each state has to pass an act, a law that allows that profession to practice. And it's at the state level. And it varies based on state. Now, what doesn't make sense to many people who are advocates for full practice authority is that there's no fundamental difference between a nurse practitioner in New York and one in Texas, for example. Yet what we can do as nurse practitioners is going to differ from that state law. So the evidence is robust. We know that there has been white papers written. There have been National Governors Association has written in support of full practice authority. And the evidence, there have been peer-reviewed studies. There have been systematic reviews that have all supported full practice authority. The challenge is inertia. You know, this is somewhat different. And we have to convince lawmakers, stakeholders that the evidence supports this practice and that it should be in all 50 states.
Well, Stephen, thanks for that. And a quick follow up. We just recently celebrated Veterans Day. And for all our veterans out there, we thank you. And for all the MPs who practice in Veteran Affairs, we thank you. And I understand that MPs in Veterans Affairs have full practice authority across the country, regardless of the state. Is that accurate that they are across the country, wherever they are, enjoying full practice authority?
Yes, that is correct. And that is a relatively recent change that took a lot of effort on those individuals who were advocating for it. Previously, if the VA facility was in a state that did not recognize full practice authority, they had to follow the laws of that state. But as of this change, this regulatory change, the VA is looked at as one continuous system across the U.S., and it no longer is impacted by your state licensure. You still need to be state licensed, but the VA recognizes, for the most part, NPs to have that full practice authority. And, you know, when I'm talking a lot about full practice authority, I think it's important to, you know, underscore that nurse practitioners have the education and competency to practice in this way. It's just sort of how those laws were written in those states, and that's what impacts practice. So we're not looking to do more or less than what we've been prepared to do. We want to be able to ease the burden on the healthcare system and increase access to healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Well, while the two of you are nurse practitioners and I'm not, we are all celebrating this week because it's National Nurse Practitioner Week, and it is really a great time to celebrate and thank the NPs and really to continue to inform the public about NPs practice. But, and not surprising, the American Medical Association argues that, quote, patients deserve care led by physicians, the most highly trained healthcare professionals. The AMA, of course, fights for physician-led care nationwide at the state and federal level. I'm wondering what your reaction is to their position.
Well, I don't comment on another organization's position.
Smart move.
I will comment in our position, AANP's position, is that patients deserve the choice to select their provider. And if that needs to be a nurse practitioner, they should be able to do so without any sort of unnecessary barriers themselves. So, you know, patients need access. AANP has recently completed a survey on the state of primary care in the United States. We found that a third of people surveyed have not seen their healthcare provider in the last year. A quarter of them are not up to date on their screenings and immunizations. This is critical. This is not one profession versus another. This is all hands on deck, the right people at the right education level, at the right time, and the right place should be able to provide the care that's necessary to keep this country healthy and be healthier going forward.
Great. Well, that's a great philosophy to approach it from. And Stephen, on this show, we're sometimes talking big, broad strokes in healthcare, and sometimes we focus on some of the minutiae that is of interest to people when we surface it. And one of those, as I would describe it, is that A few decades ago, Medicare and many commercial insurers followed their guidelines, established a policy of reimbursing the same service when provided by a nurse practitioner at 85% of what they would have paid if it was being offered by a physician. And this has all sorts of consequences about how we look at data and measure outcomes and so forth. Is this on your agenda at the association to try and perhaps impact in this time, as you say, when we need all hands on deck?
Yeah, we definitely look at pay parity across the spectrum when it comes to services provided by providers, right? And we know that there's the difference of the 85%. And what we're seeing also in real time, and I know you all talk about this, you know, is the change from the fee-for-service model to the value model. And, you know, I'm a believer personally that the direction is going to shift into this new realm. We've been talking about it for years. It still hasn't necessarily happened yet. And I think, you know, the conversations we're going to be having is not reimbursing for that one visit, but it's reimbursing based on the value and you know, the complete picture of patients, not just that one episode in time. But to be very clear to answer your question, yes, the pay parity is something that we do look at, and we want to make sure that it is equitable across the line. You know, primary care is a difficult space for any provider to be in these days because of the time constraints, the lack of access. We believe that that providers should be getting paid for the services that they're providing.
Stephen, one of the programs that we operate out of our health system is the Weizmann Institute Research Institute, really focused in on implementation and improvement science. I know that's so important to you because you're part of the faculty at Columbia University School of Nursing, have a great team of nurse researchers there. And we're proud to say one of them, Dr. O'Reilly Jacobs, completed her NP postgrad residency and fellowship training at our community health center. And she and her team are at Columbia have done really some really very interesting and fascinating research looking at the complexity of patients and their health outcomes of Medicare recipients cared for by NPs. And I'm wondering if you could just share a little of those findings with our audience.
Yeah, it's important research. And when I spoke earlier about the decades of research that exist, this is part of it. My colleagues at Columbia have found is that there is cost efficiency delivered by nurse practitioners. So it's not costing the system more for nurse practitioners to care for patients. So that's always a concern, right? Well, you know, we can't be more expensive than the alternative. We find that there is quality parity amongst the nurse practitioners and other providers. And I really don't like when we have to compare one set of providers to another.
It's just data.
It's just data.
It's just data. It's not personal, it's professional.
Exactly. And this is what we've used as putting quality metrics out in the world. But we know that the quality is there. The cost efficiencies are there. We know that when states went to COVID emergency orders, when COVID was really a full in effect across the country, many states relaxed their requirements for nurse practitioners. And what we found during that time was that nurse practitioner care quality did not suffer. So when nurse practitioners when the laws were modernized for nurse practitioners temporarily, quality of care did not suffer. So that's amongst some of the research that's been done. And, you know, we look at that and we use that when we're speaking to our lawmakers and to our legislators to help make the case for full practice authority across the board.
Well, Stephen, as you may know, our organization played a leadership role in developing the model of postgraduate NP and residency fellowship programs for new NPs who chose to complete one. There's now over 500 programs around the country, FQHCs, Veteran Affairs, but also, as I think you mentioned early on, people often don't realize psychiatry and mental health, acute yes. care, specialty care, et cetera. Initially, there were questions on the part of many of the NP organizations about the need and value of these programs. What are your thoughts now, almost 20 years down the road since the first program started?
I personally believe that there's a role for these fellowship programs, for these residencies. I know there's varied names depending on the organizations and what they're called. I know that from our AANP perspective, you know, we believe that, these programs, as long as they've been post-licensure, are absolutely fine. There should be more opportunities. And personally, I've had I sit on a few advisory boards for some of the fellowships and residencies that have been funded by HRSA, right, by the federal government. So I see firsthand the value. I see it as, you know, not a repeat of nurse practitioner school, but it's really how can we work effectively with this population over the course of the next 12 months. And most of them that I'm familiar with are about 12 months in length. I think they're popular. I wish there's more funding for them. That's one of the things that I constantly am speaking with individuals about. How do we get more funding on the nurse practitioner side, that it's very, very limited compared to medicine?
Yeah, Stephen, we lead a large primary healthcare system, the Moses Weitzman Health System. And as health systems do, we have a real broad and deep team of healthcare providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, behavioralists, dentists, a whole array of people. I know that sort of one sort of unifying factor, everyone is worried about workforce burnout, stress, and staff well-being as they work to keep up with the demands of practice. Ever since COVID, the post-COVID world has really put a lot of strain on it. I'm wondering what you and your colleagues at AANP, as well as Columbia, are looking to in terms of strategies to help address this very important issue around burnout, but also more importantly, about promoting wellness and to some degree or another, bringing joy back into the practice, right?
Right. It has to be something we do more than just talk about.
Yeah.
Because that is not going to solve the challenges. And I am looking forward to the technology that's on the horizon that is going to help with some of this. And when I say that, I'm talking about some of the new AI tools that have been introduced. And my new role at Columbia is Associate Dean of AI at the School of Nursing. So I very much have an interest in this area. And I think that, we know that the electronic health record was supposed to be this, one-stop shop that you could document and find everything you need to know about your patient. The problem is they are so vast and there is so much information in there that it's virtually impossible for an individual clinician to go through every episode that's been recorded in there. And we know that, and I talk about primary care a lot because I myself am a primary care provider, that once the day is over for a primary care provider, they may be finished seeing patients, but their documentation is something that they're probably doing up until late at night when they
Absolutely.
Get home.
Yep.
This has to change. It has to change. And I do believe that some of the AI solutions that have been proposed and that are coming will help that. It's not going to be perfect. And AI is never going to take the place. I'm going to say that. AI is never going to take the place of a human being clinician because there's just too many nuances to taking care of a human being that an AI can replace. But I'm hopeful that these newer technologies can summarize the data that we have access to, could help to ease documentation burden. And I do believe that that's going to help us mitigate some of these burnout and good clinicians leaving the profession because they can't work 18-hour days anymore with no breaks. So I'm hopeful. We have to do a lot more than just technology. It's the whole way of our health systems tend to be very a lot of administrative red tape. And I'm hopeful when I'm in meetings and hearing some healthcare executives talking about these things that they are putting resources there and trying to make a difference towards it.
Well, very well said. And I can hear heads nodding as they listen to the podcast across the country because it is such a truism, and yet we've had too few tools to do anything about it. But I wonder, in this role, inaugural Dean of Artificial Intelligence, first person I've met with that title, I know you also want to focus on patient outcomes with AI in the patient-centered approach to healthcare that is so much of what you advocate at the university and what NPs generally do. Can you give us a concrete example for our audience about how you're looking to focus on this?
Yeah, it's so we want to be able to empower patients, first of all, right? Because we know patients are using AI today, right? Mm-hmm. They're going into, they used to go into Google and put in their symptoms, and it was very crude that way, right? You're not getting a full breadth of what is possible. So now patients have turned to AI, and AI is fairly decent in some situations. I would never tell a patient to only rely on AI for their diagnoses. But I think we want to empower patients, and we want to have informed patients and informed family members of patients. And if we can help bridge some of that gap and that divide, I think there's an AI literacy aspect that is beholden to the health professions to teach patients on how to use. And the better informed a patient, the better informed a provider, we can sort of meet that patient's expectations and goals together and ultimately have those better health outcomes. There's a lot of intelligent people working on this, you know, across the country. We talk about the quadruple aim, you know, cost and reducing costs and increasing quality and reducing burnout. These are all parts of the very complicated picture today. So I think that AI is going to be important. I think it's important for us as trusted healthcare professionals to guide our patients, to walk hand in hand with our patients down this road. And it's ultimately for me, for us collectively, how do we get better outcomes? And I think there's, we have to be cautious too, right? Because I know there's concern amongst healthcare providers that, well, if we're so much more efficient, then there's going to be the pressure to see more patients or to do more with less. And we can't go down that road. We have to be able to intelligently use the technology to the best of our abilities to leverage our providers working at the top of all of their licenses, not just nurse practitioners, but all of the healthcare team. And ultimately, how can we best provide patient care and patient outcomes in a country where our outcomes are not so great, especially compared to the amount of money that we spend. So I have to be hopeful, and I've seen that there is, you know, brighter days ahead.
Talk to us a little bit about how Columbia has organized its AI work. Obviously, you're a dean there, that they view that importantly. What's your AI work look like with your other colleagues, and what's Columbia up to that folks might be interested in this particular area?
Yeah, it's multifaceted, and so at the School of Nursing, it is my role to integrate AI into our three pillars, which are research, clinical practice, and academics. Mm-hmm. So from the academic side, we want to make sure that our faculty are utilizing and are aware of the latest AI and, you know, and know some of the disadvantages of AI when it comes to teaching. That's the faculty side. On the student side, we stood up a student advisory council. Students are very, very much into this technology right now, and how can we bring faculty and students together and change expectations, or at least start set new expectations? We know that some of the technology can do things better than students can, which is going to force us to reevaluate how we evaluate students, right? May not be that term paper. We may have to do some more oral exams. We may have to go to AI and say, give me all you know about this disease, and then the student will have to critique that output. And, you know, this is how we can understand what the student can comprehend or has comprehended. Mm-hmm. So that's on the academic side. We've been lucky at Columbia that we have some nurse researchers that have been using natural language processing and machine learning before it was AI, and we'll continue to support and augment that work. One brief example there is that we have a researcher who's looked at nursing home notes and has been able to use machine learning to go through the nursing home notes and predict when a resident of the nursing home is going to have a urinary tract infection before they show, you know, overt symptoms of that UTI. So that's some of the work that's been done. And then the clinical practice, right? You know, again, integrating some of the ambient listening, the ambient scribes. How do we coalesce and summarize the information that's in a vast electronic health record? And how can we best utilize that to make decisions for our patient and patient care?
Stephen, we've just wrapped up a monumental election, and we won't ask you to get into the politics of the outcome. But any tea leaves to read about what the incoming administration will do or can do on issues of concern to the association and to the profession?
Yeah, on behalf of the association, I can say that we've worked with various administrations in the past and have been able to move forward with the agendas of modernizing nurse practitioner laws and regulations. So we look back to our past and say, we're going to continue our work. We're going to work very, very hard on making sure that nurse practitioners can practice at the top of our licenses. And the nuance here is that state law, as I mentioned earlier, is going to dictate full practice authority. But there are laws at the federal level that also arbitrarily restrict what nurse practitioners can do. So we will work with all branches of government to make sure that our priority items are addressed. And we'll continue doing that. And AANP, we have a health policy conference. It'll be in March of 25. And we'll have hundreds of nurse practitioners go to the conference, and then ends with going to the Hill and going in groups and speaking with lawmakers and legislators and making sure that they understand some of the challenges that exist and how to fix them.
Tell us a little more about AANP, how people, what you might find on your website, how people can join, how big's the membership. You talked about the conference that you're holding annually. What else can you share with our listeners?
Yeah, so AANP is over 100,000 members across the U.S. We've actually just opened up international membership because we see that the nurse practitioner profession is spreading, you know, beyond the U.S. and Canada, where it has been pretty much from the beginning. And there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from other countries' implementation of the nurse practitioner role. Certainly, a lot of countries are looking to the U.S. and see what we've done and how we've been successful. So that's one aspect of, you know, AANP membership. There's continuing education, there's advocacy and mentorship. These are all the types of things that we exist to support the practicing nurse practitioner today of all specialties, you know, from family nurse practitioners to acute care to women's health to psychiatric mental health. You will find continuing education and all things relevant and pertinent to all these specialties of nurse practitioners. So we're happy to exist and be able to, you know, support the profession.
Thank you, Dr. Stephen Ferrara, for joining us. And thanks to our audience for being here. And just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And don't forget, you can also share your thoughts and your comments about this program with us. Take care. Be well. Thank you so much, Dr. Ferrara. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.